A lot of countries have started digitizing their healthcare systems many, many years ago, about 20 years, give or take. One of the most critical success factors of digital health endeavors is the level of engagement and competence of clinicians in these projects. Now, some more digitally mature countries like Australia, the UK, Singapore, have already started chartering the territories for clinicians and physicians to make sure they're competent, they're digitally literate, etc. But these efforts still remain very fragmented and they're never really scaled beyond these geographies. Now, with the European Union investing heavily, like 1 trillion euros through 2030 to upskill a digital workforce at the magnitude of, I guess, 20 million ICT professionals that will need to be absorbed into digitization streams by 2030. Question that begs itself is for European countries, but also other countries that are willing to digitize their healthcare systems in a sustainable way, how can you ensure that the skills transferred to clinicians are the right ones, that you have enough clinicians that are competent in digital health matters, and how can you ensure, most of all, that these levels of competence are maintained over time? What can we learn from other countries and how other countries have done it? What are the lessons learned? That's the questions, and that's our discussion today.
Welcome to Health Tech Central, the podcast that connects you with the wisdom of trailblazers at the intersection of health, care, and technology. 42-ish minutes of entertaining inspiration, actionable insights, and answers to just about everything. Hitchhiking most definitely allowed. With your host, Mehdi Khaled.
Hey everyone, today we're in for a treat. Joining us is Rachel Dunscombe, a true rock star in digital health and a major force within the global health tech community. Rachel has been shaking things up as the CEO of Open Air International, redefining the boundaries of open data standards and ensuring health and care services are, let's say, a little bit more sustainable than they are today. Before that, she was at the very heart of the NHS as the CEO and co-founder of the NHS Digital Academy, where she was busy shaping future digital health leaders in the UK. She also made significant strides as the Director of Digital for the Northern Care Alliance, which became one of the most digitally advanced trusts in the entire NHS under her leadership. Her dedication to enhancing patient care through technology is second to none. And if that wasn't enough, Rachel wears many hats. She's a strategic advisor to top organizations, a member of the UK Government AI Council, and a visiting professor at Imperial College London. Very pleased to have you, Rachel, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mehdi. It's great to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
We've got so much to chat about, so let's jump right in. Rachel, you've been in health tech for quite a while, and maybe you can start by telling us, you know, how long you've been there, what attracted you to the industry, into the whole thing, and, you know, how did you make your career?
Yeah, so I originally started studying biochemistry and biomedical science, and decided that that wasn't for me and moved into tech. And I've had a really odd journey, actually, via Switzerland, working in financial services and private healthcare. But actually, the reason I ended up coming to the NHS was I had a really bad experience in the NHS myself. And basically, care that, you know, really went wrong. And I decided I was going to come and fix it and find out why this wasn't working. It was quite a conscious choice to come and work in the NHS. And I just found this environment where there was so much I and others could do to make it better. It was, you know, for me, digital healthcare is the ultimate place to work. It's like the biggest puzzle. We have so many things that we can do with technology and data and great people and so many problems to solve. So it all really actually came from that one episode of care for me that was really bad, plus also my dad's oncology journey and just really wanting to be able to improve oncology care. And so actually, in some ways, working in, you know, healthcare has been quite therapeutic for me, because it does feel like you're putting back to your family, to society. You know, it's something that's really heartwarming in some ways.
Brilliant, brilliant. And I'm sure in those somehow dramatic moments, you've also had some, let's say, funnier moments. So maybe we can start by you telling us or sharing with us one of the funny moments you've been through.
Oh, yeah. And I've been thinking about which of the funny moments to talk about. There are ones that involve rodents. There are ones that involve us hiring a bird of prey to get the rodents. But no, I'm going to talk about when I was accidentally big in Brazil. So I was at a big US conference, and there was a large delegation from Brazil and South America. And they'd asked me to talk about, you know, Salford NCA group and the work that we'd done there. So I prepped this presentation and sent it to them. And it was going to be a translator, which was good, so they could understand what I was saying. And so I remember walking along the hall to the room, and it was quite a big room, looked good, confidently went to the front, and I said to the AV guy, "Great. You got my presentation?" He said, "No." And I said, "Okay, well, I meant to be talking about, you know, what I did at Salford NCA." And he said, "No, we've got you down for community care." And I was like, okay. So, you know, Salford was community. I've done Bolton that was community. But so I said, okay, I'm going to freestyle. No slides. I'm going to freestyle with the Brazilians. So I had this kind of half hour presentation, and I freestyled, no slides, and I was talking a lot. And I was talking about some of the challenges we had in community, you know, the infrastructure, very poor, the wiring was bad, the environment was bad. It was difficult to get tech out some of the sites. And I had this translator, and the translator was getting laughs. So I was saying things about bad wiring, and then I was getting this laugh back, or I was saying things about, you know, what we used to call lucky laybys, which was places that community nurses could park up and get, you know, signal. And I'd be getting really big laughs. And I was thinking, huh, this guy's pretty good. I don't know what he's adding to the message here, but I'm getting some good laughs. And by the end of it, I got like this roaring applause and like a sort of people like coming up to me. I got people inviting me to all of these meetings. And I realized this guy was adding something, but I have no idea what he was adding. But they were giving me like the best response I've ever had from a talk. So I guess that my lesson learned there was that sometimes things are lost in translation, but sometimes things were enhanced in translation as well.
I know. I have similar experiences in Asia, but it was the other side. It was the negative experience of making jokes, cross-cultural jokes that typically don't work, but great. This is a great story. You know, I stopped doing jokes in other cultural settings, because I don't know how they come across or come through, will be interpreted. So it's sometimes safe to not do one, but great.
To be honest.
That's great. Well, look, I think the topic is the uncharted territory of these digital health careers, especially for technologists and clinicians alike. I mean, despite the fact that we've been in digital health now, let's say, give or take 30 years now, there's still such an ambiguity about, you know, career paths and where to go, what to do. And I have just in my immediate circles, I have so many friends and colleagues, medical doctors who want to venture into those territories, but they don't know where to start. They don't know what courses they need to take. They don't know what skills they need to start honing and building. And it's kind of, you know, as you said, it's kind of a freestyle journey, and everybody has to go and start by himself from scratch. And I thought it's interesting to start talking about that, because there is a lot that you probably can help some of the communities with. And talking about communities, we'll talk about communities later, but I think there is so much that we can talk about here, but maybe you can share with me, you having been on top of the NHS Digital Health Academy, maybe we can start there and then, you know, give us your views on that.
Yeah. So you brought me back to a conversation I probably had about 12 years ago with one of the CMIOs that worked for me. And It was before he worked for me, and he sat down and he said, this isn't a defined career. What does it mean? You know, where am I going? And, you know, I said, I can't answer some of those questions at this point in time. And, you know, it really dawned on me that doctors, nurses, others are given a very structured career. They can see what's coming. They can see where they're going. They can see how they get there. And digital health really has been quite nebulous. You know, we're not able to necessarily describe that to people. And I once jokingly said that this is either for the brave or the insane, because you can't see where you're going, right? But actually, we're starting to create, and with the Academy, we did create a curriculum. We created professionalism with professional bodies that you could register in. And we started creating for the UK, at least, some of that infrastructure that would describe what your journey was as a CMIO or a CNIO or, you know, as a digital health professional and what level you were registered to in a registration. And I think those things have been missing generally from the world, unless you feel like a true pioneer and are really confident. It's not been something that you felt you've got a right to do. So for me, you know, it's a really interesting set of journeys. And the people that did step forward initially are probably the more confident people, but not necessarily all of the competent people felt that they could do that.
That's interesting because, you know, as much as in the UK, the NHS is taking on that job of digital health, I would say literacy, we'll talk about the terminology in a bit, or digital health curricula or career paths. There is a similar example in Australia. The Australians, through the Australian Digital Health Agency, have done a great job in chartering the territory a little bit better. They've put a framework and they've done a great job in doing so. They can predict what kind of skills, and they are predicting actually what kind of skills and how many skills do we need in which territory of Australian territory, of course, in the next 5-10 years, and take the steps to make sure there is adequate. I always talk about competence and relevance. So you need to have the competence, but that competence needs to be relevant for the moment and for the technology using. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't help you to buy an Airbus, but we only have Boeing pilots. Talk about Boeing, but okay. So
we can bring up AI safety there.
And so I think, what would be the ideal instance for you in a setting? And we know that the EU is putting a lot of money, like triple digit billions in digital health skills through, you know, this is the EU digital decade. And so they're putting a lot of efforts and money and in terms of digital skills. And the EU needs to create about 20 million new ICT jobs to be absorbed by 2030 into the digital health ambitions of the geography. And so where do you think the instance of planning those resources and careers, et cetera, should sit in the government?
And that's really interesting because within the UK, I was part of the workforce planning where we worked out how many digital health professionals we needed through till 2028. And it is very much a government job because it's not just about healthcare. This is about schools. It's about universities. It's about nonlinear career journeys where people can come in from other disciplines. And as you said, we have what a number of us in the UK have called a skills emergency. Because by quantifying that and working out what our capacity is to create the skills we need, there's a gap. And there's going to be a gap globally. You know, Australia is doing good work, but they still have a gap as well. And so for me, it has to be a government job, because if you're going to change what you tell kids at school or the careers of the future, if you're going to change, you know, universities and how they're commissioned and what they do, if you're going to change medical education, nursing education, only a government can really do that. So, you know, it has to be done centrally. And while we have done that, we still have, you know, a way to go in the UK. But for me, that capacity and capability planning needs to be done in terms of decades. So if you're looking at what kids are taught at school now, certainly I know my kids wouldn't have a clue that you could be a digital doctor or move into digital healthcare or any of those things unless they knew me, right? And so there is a whole set of infrastructure that you need in society to get people into these careers. And some of these careers are going to take 15 years to get people ready for. So, you know, it's never too soon to start planning. As you said, the EU is going to find that it's got, you know, millions of people it needs to create for this journey. And actually, a far more effective way of doing that is to have kind of standard competencies, a standardized frame of reference across Europe that everyone is trained to. Because the worst thing is if you fragment education and skills. And as you said, you know, one person's talking this, another person's talking that. We really need a common language and a common framework.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so you're talking about language and framework, and you're a standards professional as well. So I love standards, and I think that's a good way to harmonize the delivery of care and reduce variations and variabilities in delivering care. I think we need to be, let's say, consequent as well in putting those programs together in terms of content and outputs for the sake of having a homogeneous healthcare delivery system. And so it starts with that. Now, in terms of terminology, talking about standards, we interchangeably talk about skills, talk about proficiency, talk about literacy. And I think, and we had this discussion before, Rachel, the term literacy sounds to me as if let's give them some literacy. Let's talk about hieroglyphs and maybe teach them some signs and symbols so they can at least understand or have a glimpse of that, what that means. So the word literacy to me is really an underestimation of the effort that needs to be taken into, you know, building competence. Proficiency is kind of bizarre. Skills is just skills, because to me, you know, knowledge is about learning, but competence is a real world. Competence is about people. And so I think relevance and competence are the two words that we increasingly, I feel that we need to surround ourselves with. And so, you know, in that hodgepodge of programs that the EU is doing, I'm sure there should be some reason at some point to harmonize that and bring it to the level of competency or competence we're talking about. So what's your take on that? Where do you think things can come together?
Yeah. So it's real world competency. It's really important that this is learning that is done in the real world. Yeah. And actually one of the biggest attributes that people forget is leadership, because many of these positions are going to have to lead. So it's, you know, I talk about catalyzing people to become real world leaders. And yes, skills and so on are fine for the wider, you know, workforce. We need literacy and skills for the wider workforce. But for those people working in digital health, we need more leaders. We need more people that can evidence this in the real world and build confidence and competence as they do. And so, you know, I think for me, traditionally, education has been very, we used to call it sage on the stage, people talking at you. And I actually taught last week at a university in Europe, and they said, but we can't normally answer professors back. We can't challenge them or ask them a question. I was like, this is a debate that we're all having. This is about us all learning together, right? Education does need to change. And I think that we need to catalyze more individuals who have got this real world competency, but are also excellent leaders. And everybody has a way of leading. It's about you learning how you lead as an individual. Yeah. So my experience has been the academy where, you know, Lord Aridazi, you know, co-director there, absolutely brilliant, allowing us to really work with people to develop them as leaders. And also the other thing is to develop their curiosity, right? If you're not curious about this space, if you're not interested and wanting to know more, then you're not going to be an effective leader, because this is about continued development. Yeah. As you said earlier, this is a moving target. So this isn't about skilling up a workforce once or, you know, building competencies once. It's about, starting a journey that never ends. Yeah. And curiosity for me is the main skill that keeps people engaged. So you get people really interested. What can this do, you know, for me as a doctor? What can this do for my organization? You know, getting people to actually find things that they want to get really deep and involved with. And so building in curiosity, and part of that is to change the traditional education, because traditional education, where we talk as professors at people, is very different to the co-collaboration, action learning, communities of practice, and all of those things where everybody's involved and everybody has something to add. And I think we're going to see education change as we move along this sort of journey, because it's the only way to create those individuals that we need who will keep learning for life.
Yeah, lifelong learning, that's a real keyword there. I think it's, as you said, it's a moving target, and we need to be adaptive. We need to be aware, as we see. I mean, there are two topics specifically to leadership that are clinical or clinicians' leadership and political leadership. And these two types of leaderships need to be, in my opinion, and in my experience as well, not only aware of what's going on in technology, but on top of things, to be able to make, because they're decision makers in most occasions. People are decision makers, and people are in leadership positions. You can't make the right decision about something that you don't understand. And it's a problem.
Absolutely.
And it's beyond literacy. It's really relevant competence for the topic. And what we're seeing with AI right now, in my opinion, is the biggest double-blind study ever in healthcare. So nobody knows what we're doing, but everybody's talking about it and investing money, investing, you know, in technologies, etc. So I think clinical and political leadership in digital health are crucial.
Yeah, and navigating that journey together. So digital health is a team sport, and, you know, none of us can ever know, you know, all of it or even a fraction of it. So it's about your network. So how you work with experts, how you get expert opinion. And as you said, you know, in this AI space, it's something I've been trying to navigate for a number of years, but constantly every day it brings new conversations that help take us forward in terms of navigating. The hype of AI is a very interesting case in point. We need, you know, competent people who can navigate and temper some of that hype, in my view.
Yeah, interesting. So you mentioned one keyword for me as well. Just now you said communities of practice. And so think that increasingly having skilled people or competent people in a specific subject matter in digital health and health technologies in general, because technologies are emerging. We talk biotech and interchangeably, we talk technologies, as in digital health is a technology, biotech is a technology. And now interchangeably, this platform is more for, let's talk everything health tech, not only digital, but then in digital health, the competencies that we are building or putting together or ramping up, they can't be sustained if they're just siloed and everybody's competent for himself. So competencies need to be nurtured. And as we do in medicine, actually, there are groups of specialists who come together under associations or under different groups to discuss specific cases and advance science and clinical settings in a practical way. And you said communities of practice. So I wonder what's your take on setting up communities of practice in the digital health space in a specific country, as the NHS has been very successful in setting up communities of practice elsewhere, like for medication and patients, etc. Maybe you can tell us more about that.
We've learned very much from the, you know, the other parts of the NHS that have done this, particularly from those that have worked on quality and quality improvement and the communities of practice there. So certainly for the Academy, we set up action learning sets and communities of practice. And what's been really nice is some of those communities of practice who were, you know, formed 6 years ago, after they've finished the program, they've continued and are being facilitated as kind of lifelong, you know, communities of practice. And these communities of practice, as I said, this is a team sport, right? Digital health, I don't think, maybe we've got some lone wolves in the back room who are doing something very technical, but those who are leading digital health need to be part of communities. We've almost got the hive mind, right? I've always thought, you know, if I get any problem or I'm asked anything and I don't know, I've got this kind of Rolodex of people I've built high trust relationships with who I know will have a perspective, who I can call and actually give me, you know, a triangulation of something. And I'm on so many WhatsApp groups and you know, signal groups where I can go and check in with people. You know, what's your view on this? Where do you think this will be going? And I'm actually part of a community of practice myself that meets once every week. So for me, those networks, we cannot underestimate the value of those things, because they give everybody an ability to continue learning, but also an ability to have an expert reference group around them, or set of expert reference groups. And when I joined Digital Health, we were all taught to compete with each other. You've got to be better than the organization next to you. Don't talk to them. Don't tell them how you do something. We've moved a long way. And I'm really heartened by that, because also in the quality improvement space, having seen and witnessed, certainly at Salford, where we get, you know, outstanding care, how communities of practice drove that. I am absolutely sure that that model is the future model. And I also think that it builds resilience into individuals as well. So again, having seen the communities of practice we've set up, where there are individuals that are having a very difficult time in their organization or personal issues, those communities of practice really are there for those individuals too. And it gives them an ability to develop that resilience and that support they may not have, you know, in the workplace. So I think that there are multiple factors that make communities of practice efficient. I think it's important that you set them up correctly and they've got the right parameters and the right bounds. For me, action learning sets are really interesting. If people have not looked into those, they are fantastic. That's where a community work together on something actionable and take it forward and learn as they do. And a big shout out to Alison Singleton that, you know, sort of set that up and facilitated that for the Academy. But I'm absolutely convinced that using that as the bedrock for learning, education and lifelong learning has a kind of network effect. And that network effect is about who you are, you know, sort of in your community of practice with and who they then associate with as well. You get this kind of exponential ability to get knowledge, skills, support, all of the things that actually make your life easier. And I've got to say, acting as that kind of lone wolf CIO, because you're not encouraged to talk to others, versus this model, certainly as I saw it move over 20 years, for me, it became a lot easier and actually a lot, you know, more enjoyable because it was more social.
Yeah, that's truly insightful. I mean, the topic of leadership at this level could be dissected in what we call collective leadership as opposed to individual leadership. That's what communities of practices promise is. And I think moving into a space of collective leaderships is an interesting space, because then all of a sudden you're not alone, and all of a sudden you can ask your peer groups, and all of a sudden you can have validation or not through your peer group in a non-hierarchical way. Because as you know, communities of practice are built at the social level, yes, and not at hierarchical level. So staying at the same level and having people have the same word at the same level with the same value brings a lot of trust between people and builds a lot of value over time through these, what we call the, you know, collective leadership groups. You said something about networks. Networks is, you know, having a network is great, but having a purpose is, I think, even better. So communities of practice typically also are, you know, band together for a specific purpose, and they can, once that purpose is or once that task is achieved, they can move on and do and create another community of practice for another topic, and that's fine. So, you know, the equivalent of that, which is not really a community of practice, is what HIMSS calls chapters, but we know that chapters are different, a different construct. Just to talk about that, it's a different construct. It's hierarchical. It has a chair. You know, it's networking, but networking for business purposes. It's lobbying. It's not, and it's more in North America, etc. So just to have the topic off the table, the HIMSS chapters are not communities of practice. Communities of practice are something completely different, with a different setup and purpose, and you know, all these links that make a community practice really helpful.
And I'd agree with that, that they're focused on a problem or a set of problems or a theme, and it's a set of people taking a journey where everyone is participating, yeah? And that, for me, it's almost a democratization of solving some problems and learning as you go. So it's very different. Again, you know, there is value in the different types of networking or structures that, you know, we can have. But if it was me advising Europe, I would very much say communities of practice and action learning, you're going to go a lot further, a lot faster.
I know. And it's almost, you know, the level of investment is really minimal, because, you know, a lot of communities of practice I know today are, you know, they meet virtually once a month or something. You don't have to have a physical space. It can produce things that are, you know, uploaded and shared. It's good to meet people. It's good to have a physical connection or relationship and be there, like physically see, touch and smell people. It's great, right? But, you know, it's really low cost and high output. And this is something that we can love. I compare it to the, you know, the kite effect. You have the handlebar, and you move the handlebar by 1 centimeter and the kite travels like 150 meter on the other side. So that's the kite effect that I see in communities of practice, you know, very low cost, very high output, because it generates, you know, it amplifies the leadership and it amplifies the output. And you're never a prophet in your own village, right? So sometimes you have to amplify your voice through someone else saying the same things you want to say, and something can help.
And that's a really good point, actually, because one thing I've seen with communities of practice is being able to bring some people from your community of practice to support a business case or go to your board with you, whatever else. There's this sense of creating a movement of people that can make something move forward where one person can't, because it's the triangulation of, you know, expert opinion. And, you know, another of the benefits is you are catalyzing your talent into, you know, more confident and competent people with those real world competencies as part of this. So, you know, it is part of building capacity and capability. And we all need to do that. The whole planet needs to do that. So, you know, traditional education will not provide everybody you need. We have to get innovative about this.
Yeah, the other part of the communities of practice is when you produce, say, a practice, or when you produce like general guidelines or something that is successful somewhere, there are always pros and cons, and there are always limitations with things that we do anyway. And so one of the things that are often not talked about when we talk about benchmarks is when you take a output from a community of practice, say focusing on, let's say, telemedicine, to just put a topic on the table. That practice of telemedicine, the communities of practice guidelines or recommendations would be then very specific to the context within which the telehealth application or instance would be applied, or service would be, let's call it service, would be applied, right? And so the problem with benchmarks is they always come with this illusion that they are replicable, like one-to-one. You take it, you put it, and it works. And that's something that actually calls for another community of practice in the new setting that is actually looking at these benchmarks and make sense of it within the current context. So having a community of practice focusing on telehealth somewhere doesn't mean that I can take that output and put it in my instance, in my geography, one-to-one, without thinking about the consequences.
Right. And that adoption and adaption of what has been proven or evidenced elsewhere is incredibly important. We don't really talk enough about this in healthcare. And so we talked about Salford NCA Group, where I was CIO. It was a city of two halves. One media city with the BBC headquarters, lots of, you know, digital sort of millennials and all of those things working on media. The other half, some of the most deprived areas of the UK, yeah, with a motorway in the middle. And even within that environment, just telehealth. How do you adopt and adapt that for the millennials? Well, they're going to uptake it really quickly. How do you get people that can't afford a mobile phone, who are, you know, in insecure housing, you know, to actually adopt this? It makes you really realize that there is an element, a very human element here around understanding your demographics, your population, what's applicable. And I've learned from working with very different populations that you can't just lift something that is, you know, a blueprint and say, this is going to work here. You've got to do that adopt and adapt piece. And if we don't, it goes horribly wrong, you know? So knowing your citizens, and I think this is another thing, it's something we did a lot of work on the academy with. We did co-design with citizens, yeah? Really having the citizen in the room as an equitable voice, or citizens in the room as an equitable voice, where they can really challenge back all the presumptions the health system has about them. So some of the presumptions I've made are, well, okay, people in this demographic with renal failure don't want to use apps. Actually, the vast majority, even the over 65s, do, right? And then a presumption in other areas that, you know, digital is going to be the answer. And then having the reality check that perhaps something more analog is appropriate because they need face-to-face services. So this whole sort of design piece of taking a benchmark, as you say, you know, we benchmark badly for, you know, a certain condition. Say, you know, diabetes or pre-diabetes, but what does that mean in my population? Who are those people? What are their needs? And so with the whole digital education piece, it's far more than technology and data. And actually with the academy, we had a strapline, people before technology, because actually you need to know the people you're serving before you can actually look at what that data, what the technology solutions mean.
Brilliant. Women leaders in digital health.
Yeah.
That's a topic that is dear to my heart, because I'd like to see more of those, more of you, Rachel. In my own experience, I can tell you that working in the Middle East, having had projects in the Middle East and still having projects in the Middle East working at digital health level, most of the time senior executive level, I can tell you that, for example, a country like Saudi Arabia, for the same level of competence between men and women, in my experience, women are way more reliable. That's a fact. Like Russell Peters said, I don't make stereotypes, I only see them. And so, you know, I'd like to see more of that, because we want to be more efficient at the workplace. We want to see things moving. And, you know, having that dynamic, I think, brings not only balance into the system, but in my opinion, brings also more reliability. What do you think about that? I mean, you come from a tech family. It's easy for you to have followed the path you're on now.
What's
your take on that?
It's interesting, because when I entered the kind of tech field, gosh, 20 odd years ago, you know, it was really male dominated. I was often the only woman in a room. Yeah. And as you said, I come from a tech family. My mum was a programmer. My dad took me to coding club rather than my brother on the kind of really old big computers at the university. So I always had that kind of script that, hey, women do this and you're meant to do it and it's good and we back you, you know? So I always felt kind of like, where are the other women, you know? And I actually gave myself a challenge of growing women leaders. So big shout out to people like Philippa Winter that I left behind as the CIO at Bolton after me, because, you know, it's really important for me to grow women leaders. I think we are coming to a new leadership horizon. So as I said before, previously it was about the top-down leadership. It was about siloism. It was about protect what we do. Don't let anyone else know. That was 20 odd years ago. Now we're in a world of collaborative leadership, sharing, working together. It's kind of a matrix of creating value across organizations, across the world. Yeah. And I think that we are finding a lot more women stepping forward who are creating those sorts of dynamics. And I think that is brilliant. I think we've also got a lot of the old traditional male leadership that is, you know, slowly retiring off, who did the siloism. And so for me, I am not sure whether it's associated with gender in any way. I would say we had a lot of men and they were the old school. And now we're bringing in a different cadre of leadership with a different set of competencies. And a lot more of those are women. Quite a lot of them are men too, in my experience. And it's interesting you say the women are more reliable. In my experience, there have been women and men who are reliable, but it's been traditionally a male workforce. So I think we've got a bias that we see the ones who haven't been reliable, and it's mainly been men. You know, for the future, this is about every voice being around the table. You talk about action learning sets, you talk about leadership. If you have younger leaders, older leaders, women, men, people from different backgrounds, people with different conditions or family experiences themselves, the broader the leadership we have, the better the answer we get, because between them, they have more experience in and can play out that 360 perspective. And so, you know, balanced leadership for me is really important. I've got to say, within the UK, one thing that we've really had a problem with is our Black population are not represented in leadership in digital health. And I've certainly worked with HDR UK on the, sort of programs to bring in more women, more people from our Black communities. We need to rebalance our leadership overall, is my view. But yeah, for me, I've always felt I've had permission, but a lot of women haven't, you know? And so it's, again, we talked about clinicians being encouraged to take this journey. I've spoken with a lot of women who have not known anyone in this space. And there's that saying, you have to see one to be one. I could see one. I could see people in my family that worked in tech. And so if there's anything I can do, it's to be there to talk to them about this and say, yeah, I could do it. You could do it. You know, I think that role modeling is really important. And I think actually, probably as women, when we do want to succeed, my mom always said to me, you will have to be better than the men around you to succeed. I don't know if she was right or not, but I always felt the need to actually prove that I could do it. And maybe men haven't had that feeling because they inherently get the right to be there. So maybe we do go over and above. Maybe that won't last because we feel got the right to be there at some point. So yeah, the jury's still out on that for me, but it's brilliant seeing so many wonderful women in this space. And actually, you know, to have a network of women in digital health now for me, that's very different to 20 years ago.
That's brilliant. And I mean, context is always very important, right? So I think the example I've given you about the women in Saudi Arabia stems from the fact that women have not been part of the workplace for decades. And now when those doors and curtains and windows have opened, it's almost they want to prove a point. They want to, you know, they want to go there and, you know, prove that I can do this and I can be better than the men who have been here forever, right? And so it's almost the point that you're making here, that you're saying you have to prove, like your mother told you, you have to prove to be better than men. And that's dynamics, the group dynamic and the contextual dynamic is also important. And I think we need to foster that more, encourage people to come out and encourage them to become leaders.
Yes. And the more women and the more diverse our leadership, the more I think we will move forward. So yeah, amazing to see these sorts of journeys as people succeed. And certainly I can think of at least one wonderful woman CIO in Saudi who is one of my heroes. So, you know, I think they're doing an amazing job of how quickly they're opening up the talent pool there. It's fantastic to see.
That's great. Last few words, maybe your recommendations or your lessons learned across your journey. You know, what are the do's and don'ts? What can you tell our listeners? What can they learn from your journey? What can they learn from your experience? You have so much to share.
So I think go back to the curiosity piece, right? Work out what makes you curious, what you really want to learn more about. You've got a right to, you know, get involved and get interested in things and do things you're passionate about, right? If you're not passionate about this and it doesn't kind of bring you enjoyment, it may not be the right career for you. So, you know, find out what you're really passionate about. Look after people and have empathy. I think the empathy works on two levels. One, it's about looking after, you know, those around you and they will look after you, but also that empathy and you know, becoming empathetic towards the patient or the clinician or the situation also allows you to develop better solutions for healthcare. So I think empathy is really important, as is equity. So the equity question for me, you know, creating solutions that serve all of the populations that we work with is really important. So, you know, becoming engaged with equity, understanding what equity is, and understanding how you can actually measure and improve equity, that's really important to me too. So there are things that I've kind of learned along my journey. I think lifelong learning, again, you know, I keep learning. It is part of the curiosity bit, but equally, I've been slightly bloody-minded about learning in the past, as in my employers, you know, in the old days, we would not have got any money for our own learning and I would pay for my own courses or development or whatever, conferences, yeah? So I've kind of been, I know I need to invest in myself so I can do better. And luckily now we're getting, you know, to a better situation where there's continued professional development, as there should be. So I think curiosity and education are sort of linked, or curiosity and skills are linked. For us, we need to keep challenging ourselves. So, you know, I bought a DJI drone, and thank you, because that was partly inspired by the videos you did, Mehdi. And we've been testing that out and you know, trying it and looking at how it works. Great use cases actually around deliveries in certain parts of the world for healthcare, actually looking at delivering bloods for road traffic accidents. The big drones that, you know, I've actually been in touch, they've got some which are for recovery in the battlefield or in trauma situations. So, you know, drones are pretty interesting for the future. They'll become, you know, something we have to engage with. In terms of AI, we all need a perspective on AI, and it's been overhyped, as you said, Mehdi, vastly overhyped. For me, it's like an iceberg. Under the iceberg, you've got, you know, our data, is it ready? No, we've got to get our data ready. Our governance, we've got to get that ready. Medical, you know, clinical, what does that mean for new job roles? How do you rearrange pathways to take this AI into account? There is a massive piece under AI that will need to be considered. And again, just playing with these things and understanding what they can and can't do is really important. I've been playing with a couple of large language models, creating different data sets and seeing how accurately it can actually create patient records for me against a real patient record. So there's some interesting stuff here. But, you know, your lifelong learning journey is not necessarily about you know, going and sitting through a set of university courses and collecting all of these certificates. It's about poking the box. It's about learning what things can do. You know, I read books. I'm going to have some MOOCs that I'll probably do coming up. But really, it's about saying, what can I see, you know, ahead? And for me, AI is the biggest thing that we need to have some discursive conversation about. So I'm just taking in as many perspectives as I can about AI. And I'm actually next week at the UN General Assembly talking about AI. I don't have all of the answers, but I have a lot of questions that I'd like to debate out with people and some evidence. So, you know, lifelong learning is something we need to all challenge ourselves to, because this keeps moving faster. So reading up every day, engaging with something every day, talking to people in your action learning sets, your communities, practice whatever every day is really important.
Excellent. Thank you, Rachel. Always inspiring to be talking to you. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me, Mehdi, and thanks for getting me into drones as well.
You're most welcome. I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
This has been Health Tech Central. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast channel and give us a rating or review. Finally, you can check out our news on healthtechcentral.io and inspire us with your feedback. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next exciting episode of Health Tech Central.